Techno-feudalism describes a cycle. Individualists, those who are losing within the capitalist system, lament their inability to succeed. Meanwhile, other individuals collaborate to build the systems they desire. These collaborators ultimately win, creating powerful monopolies. The losing individualists then collectively fail against these new monopolies, only to later replicate the same pattern. They believe they can build a fairer world for individual competition, yet they will inevitably be overcome by new groups who gain wealth and power through collaboration, an outcome inherent to any human-made system. The statement presents a structural critique of socioeconomic evolution. 1. A rigged game. It posits that pure, atomized individualism within modern capitalism is a losing strategy. The system's rewards flow not to the archetypal, self-made loner, but to networked collaboratives. 2. The collaboration monopoly trap. Successful collaboration doesn't lead to a utopia. It leads to the consolidation of power and new monopolies. The techno-feudal platforms like Amazon, Google, Meta. The winners become the new ruling class. 3. A cycle of naivety and failure. The core implication is a feudal cycle. Losers, motivated by a desire for a fair individual competition, rebel, build new systems, win, and, driven by the same systemic incentives, unwittingly recreate the monopolistic structures they originally opposed. Collaboration for success is seen as inevitable, making any fair individualist competition impossible. 4. Systemic inevitability. The final clause suggests this isn't a bug of capitalism, but a feature of any complex human system. It implies a Hobbesian or Darwinian view where scale and collective power always trump isolated effort, leading to perpetual hierarchy. A possible solution. To break this deterministic cycle, solutions must address the rules of the system itself, not just who is winning within it. The goal is to design structures that harness the power of collaboration without permitting the reformation of extractive monopolies. The solution lies in institutionalizing redistribution and democratic ownership into the fabric of successful collaboration. 1. Pre-competitive collaboration and open infrastructure. Support massive public and collective investment in open source protocols, open data sets, and standardized digital public goods, like a public digital payments infrastructure or an open social graph. This creates a common level playing field on which individuals and small entities can truly compete, reducing the advantage of private monopoly building. 2. Mandatory profit and governance sharing. Legally mandate new corporate structures, for example, platform cooperatives or governed data trusts for large digital platforms. These would require users and workers to have ownership stakes and voting rights in the platforms they sustain, transforming them from feudal estates into democratic commons. 3. Radical anti-monopoly and interoperability policy. Enforce antitrust laws to break up monopolies, and more critically, mandate interoperability, e.g. forcing large messaging apps to work with smaller ones, or social media profiles to be portable. This makes crashing out against a monopoly less final, as alternatives can connect to the dominant network. 4. Universal basic capital income. Provide a material base, e.g. through a sovereign wealth fund distributing dividends, or a UBI, that de-risks individual experimentation and provides bargaining power outside of the dominant collaborative monopolies. This reduces the desperate need to join the winning team to survive. The aim is to move from a cycle of replicating feudalism to a spiral of increasing democratic agency. This acknowledges the inevitability of collaboration, but seeks to hard-code its benefits as widely distributed public goods rather than privately captured power. It accepts that fairness cannot mean a return to mythical individual competition, but must mean a system where the fruits of collective success are democratically owned and shared. If those who wish to overthrow current power structures only intend to replace them with systems that benefit themselves and their group, rather than delivering on their stated ideal of creating a fairer system for all, shouldn't those already in power remain until a movement can genuinely deliver on such a promise? This is an excellent and profound political question that strikes at the heart of revolution, reform, and human nature. Let's break down the logic and its implications. The core argument, the case for the status quo. The question presents a powerful, pragmatic, even conservative argument. One, the critique of hypocrisy. Many revolutionary movements claim the moral high ground of justice and fairness for all, but are often, in practice, motivated by a desire to seize power for their own group, class, or ideology. Two, the risk of disruption. Overthrowing a system is inherently destructive, causing chaos, violence, and suffering. If the new rulers are just as self-serving as the old, then the immense cost of revolution was paid for a mere change of management, not systemic improvement. Three, the devil you know principle. An established power structure, however flawed, provides some stability, predictability, and order. Replacing it with an untested group that may be equally or more corrupt is a dangerous gamble. Four, the burden of proof. Therefore, the argument concludes, the incumbents should remain until challengers can prove, not just promise, that their alternative will genuinely be more fair and benefit a broader populace. The status quo is the default because it exists. The counterargument, why this logic can be problematic. While pragmatically sound, this position faces significant philosophical and historical challenges. One, it legitimizes stagnation and entrenched injustice. This logic could be used to defend every oppressive regime in history, from monarchies to colonial powers to dictatorships. It tells the oppressed, you must endure until your oppressor's replacements meet an impossibly high standard of moral purity. This is often a recipe for perpetuating injustice. Two, the perfect solution fallacy. It sets an unrealistic standard. No human system is perfectly fair, and all are run by self-interested humans. Demanding a guaranteed perfect outcome before allowing change paralyzes all progress and ignores the very real harms of the current system. Three, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The argument assumes the current power structure is static, but unchecked power tends to become more corrupt, more extractive, and less accountable over time. Waiting indefinitely for a perfect alternative can allow a bad system to become intolerably worse. Four, who judges the promise? The current powers are the judges in their own case. They will almost always deem challengers unworthy and their promises insufficient, as accepting them means relinquishing their own power. A possible path forward. Evaluating changemakers instead of a binary choice between stay or overthrow, a more nuanced approach involves scrutinizing the process and principles of the challengers, not just their promises. One, focus on institutions, not personalities. Does the proposed new system have strong, transparent institutions like independent courts, a free press, and checks and balances that would limit any leader's or group's ability to act purely in self-interest? A plan for robust institutions is more credible than a promise from a charismatic leader to be fair. Two, look for inclusion in the process. Are the challengers building a broad coalition, or is it a narrow group seeking vengeance or privilege? A movement that incorporates diverse voices in its struggle is more likely to consider them in its governance. Three, examine the theory of change. Is the goal merely to occupy the existing corrupt structures, which suggests they just want to be the new corrupt elites? Or is it to fundamentally redesign the structures of power and resource distribution? The latter is a better indicator of a genuine desire for systemic fairness. 4. The role of gradual reform. Often the most stable path is not sudden overthrow, but relentless pressure from within and outside the system. Through protest, journalism, law, and civil society, to force the existing powers to reform themselves toward greater fairness. This avoids the vacuum and violence of collapse. Conclusion. The question rightly identifies the central tragic dilemma of political change. The fight against tyranny is often led by those who would become tyrants themselves. The answer is not necessarily keep the current powers forever, but to raise the standard for what constitutes a credible alternative. The best insurance against a new tyranny is not the old tyranny, but a movement pre-committed to building limits on power, enforceable rights, and inclusive institutions. Therefore, the incumbents should not remain simply because they exist, but they should only be replaced when the challengers offer a demonstrable institutional blueprint for greater fairness that is more trustworthy than their inevitable human flaws. The burden of proof is on the challenger, but the burden of justification for ongoing injustice remains eternally on the current power.